of 1945 was a typical South Florida winter day. Variable winds, a chilly morning, balmy afternoon with clear skies. Fort Lauderdale Naval Air Station, now Hollywood Fort Lauderdale International Airport, was a bustle of activity. World War II had been over nearly 4 months. In addition to the permanently based ship's company and those assigned to the base for TBM, Torpedo Bomber Medium School, there was a large complement of Navy and Marine personnel awaiting discharge. Headlines in the Miami Herald that day read, CIO splits with Truman. The weatherman had forecast a temperature drop to 38 degrees for the following morning. Three Marine gunnery students at the base, Sergeant Robert Gallivan of Northampton, Massachusetts, Private First Class Robert Grubel of Long Island City, New York, and Corporal Alan Costner of Kenosha, Wisconsin, couldn't have cared less about politics or tomorrow's weather. As they returned to their barracks from the mess hall after lunch, the subject of their conversation was being home for Christmas. I'm reading from The Devil's Triangle by Richard Weiner. Is there a connection between the Bermuda Triangle and Atlantis and the world before the flood? Well, we'll see. Their concern was not Truman and the weather, but whether to be home for Christmas and whether to attend the first or second show at the base theater that night. Picture was What Next, Corporal Hargrave, starring Robert Walker, a movie they'd never see. All three. Now, if you want me to get to where I was, you got to listen to what I'm saying. All three. Now, I might finish this tonight. Just might. All three were scheduled to participate in a training. Now, do you understand what I'm trying to point out to you about this Bermuda Triangle? Strange things go on in the Bermuda Triangle. What's it got to do with God and the Bible and the pre-flood? We'll see, won't we? You understand that I just want to make one point and want you to gestalt it. Now, you just think about it a minute. Just saying that word makes you feel smart. Gestalt. Did you ever see What Next, Corporal Hargrave? Got a few oldies. Huh? You've seen it? You weren't even born. Your father hadn't even thought about you. All three were scheduled to participate in a training flight that afternoon with a squadron of five Navy TBMs, also known as Avengers. Having over an hour before they were to report to the flight line, the three Marines decided to sack out in their bunks for a while. When it came time to leave the barracks for the operations building and the pre-flight briefing, Corporal Costner had a strange premonition not to go on the flight. You know, I'd like to finish this tonight. To get himself excused was no problem because he had already completed his required flight time for that month. Bob Gallivan and Bob Grubel, along with 12 other Marine and Navy flyers, reported to the operations center. The mission of the day for Flight 19, one of the great mysteries of the Bermuda Triangle. The mission of the day for Flight 19, as the squadron was designated, was a routine navigation exercise. Little did any of the six. Now, you remember what the context is of what we're doing here. We've been studying the pyramid in Egypt. And we've said, Who built the damn thing? Now, that offends some Christians, because I have described the pyramid the way many of them have said it is. Now, I've known Christians for years been damning the pyramid, saying it's of the devil. But if I say the damn pyramid, they backslide over me saying that. It's okay to damn it, but don't ever say it. D-A-M-N pyramid. Some of my dogs are in finished work for Schutzen, or attack dog, command attack dog training. German Shepherds, and Dobermans. And I was reminded of some Christians when I went out to put them through their paces at the animal college, as the trainer is communicating what he spent 3 months ingraining into these dogs. You say, now say C-O-M-E. Or say D-O-W-N. Or say S-I-T. Or say S-T-A-Y. Because they never say it for fear the dog would do what he said. Or T-A-K-E. E-M. Take 'em. You spell it to keep him being airborne. You know, that's the way some Christians cuss. Like they got a demon around that'll hear the command. Like, I mean, they would never say, to hell with the devil. Where in it? I want to know where in hell you want him to be. Now, I'd like to be specific. Put him right there in the room. I just wanted to make sure you woke up at midnight, I said. We're trying to figure out who built the damn thing. I don't think it's damned. I just said that to accommodate Christians who think it is. When I say it that way, it kind of shocks them into the realization they might have prematurely damned something that God was the architect for. The pyramid in Egypt is one of the greatest mysteries in this world. But it's not the only one. Remember Landsat 2? Taking pictures 500 miles up, saw these eight little dots in the Ecuadorian jungles or the Peruvian jungles on the edge of the Amazon. And when they flew over them in the jungle, they found there were 12 pyramids, almost the height of the one in Egypt. And then we went to the Bermuda Triangle, and this poor mayor's candidate flying his plane low. Something comes up out of the water. And we got in the Coast Guard ship, Yamacraw. And they encountered this black mass. And then Dr. Valentine found these causeways off Bimini. And Dr. Brown swam underwater and encountered this pyramid and took the crystal out of the metal hands and got out. And Harry Marshall, the Greek industrialist, filmed this pyramid underwater. We've been reading about that, right? And we've been trying to establish a lot of strange things happen. This poor old couple in their 55th anniversary are on the boat in clear water, and all of a sudden their lunches, dinner's in their lap. Boat lifts 45 degrees, and these two poor guys about to go to port, and a ball of fire comes at them. Well, that's the context. Now, Flight 19, I'd like to take the trip here. I mean, I'd like to follow them. The mission of the day for Flight 19, as the squadron was designated, was a routine navigation exercise. Little did any of the six Navy and eight Marine airmen realize. Now, all I'm trying to point out is strange things go on in the Bermuda Triangle. You got that?
Yes, sir.
Little did any of the six Navy and eight Marine airmen realize. I don't know whether this, all of these things happening. There's just too much here to ignore. Little. Did any of the 6 Navy and 8 Marine airmen realize that their operation was to climax in what the Navy would later refer to as one of the strangest unsolved mysteries of the sea? 24 years later, Alan Cosner returned to Fort Lauderdale Airport to participate in a documentary film about strange unsolved mysteries of the sea, and boy, was he glad he didn't go. For Sergeant Gallivan, a veteran aerial gunner with 3 years of Pacific combat duty, this was just another routine flight. To Private First Class Grubel, with less than a year in the service, this was another wonderful opportunity to fly. His buddies named him Yo-Yo because of his eagerness to fly whenever he could. His goal in life, however, was to enter the priesthood after his enlistment expired, and he had just written home that he would see his family at Christmas Mass in a few short weeks. Flight 19 was under the command of Lieutenant Charles C. Taylor of Corpus Christi, Texas, a 6-year Navy veteran. Flying with him in the lead plane were, and the crews are named, from Brooklyn to Arkansas City, Kansas, Kimbrough, Minnesota, Bloomfield, New Jersey, New Ulm, Minnesota, Lexington, Illinois, Piedmont, Missouri, Mount Vernon, New York, Chicago, Illinois, New York. It was 1:30 p.m. when the 5 pilots and their crews reported to the flight deck for a pre-flight check of their respective planes. The Avenger was one of the largest and most powerful single-engine propeller planes ever built. It was used for both aircraft carriers and island bases. The wings could be folded back for carrier use, and it had a wingspan of over 52 feet and was powered by a 1,600-horsepower Wright Cyclone engine. The plane was able to attain an airspeed of nearly 300 miles per hour and could carry either a torpedo or 2,000 pounds of bombs. You that know your history of the war, they sank the world's largest battleship, the Yamato, and 6 Japanese ships in that airborne attack went to the bottom less than an hour after the first Avenger spotted them. These are not gliders. That's the point. I like the Gestalt things. Flight 19's pre-flight weather check showed surface winds of 20 knots. Remember, Close Encounters of the Third Kind? They tried to take a page out of this by having those pilots show up. But they're in the wrong place. They weren't in the desert. It was the Bermuda Triangle. But anyway, Flight 19's pre-flight weather check showed surface winds of 20 knots with gusts to 30 and scattered clouds. Although these conditions would have been rough for small boats, it was the kind of weather TBMs were built to fly in. At 2 p.m., Lieutenant Taylor's plane was airborne. And 10 minutes later, the 5 planes with their 14 men were in formation and winging east over the Atlantic toward the wreck of a target ship just south of Bimini in the Bahamas. After making their mock torpedo runs at the concrete hulk, Flight 19 regrouped and commenced with the day's mission, a routine navigation training flight that was scheduled to take them due east for 160 miles, north for 40 miles, and then west-southwest back to their base, a triangular course that fit well into the Bermuda or Devil's Triangle. At 3:45, 15 minutes before the flight was due to land, Corporal Cosner, the one who stayed home, was in the barracks day room sealing a letter he had just written to his parents. 150 miles up the Florida coast at Banana River Naval Air Station, now Patrick Air Force Base, serving Cape Canaveral, Lieutenant Harry G. Cohn of Gainesville, Florida, and his crew of 12 men had just reported to the operations room. Under routine procedure, they were to stand by as the ready crew should any of the huge Martin Mariner PBM flying boats base there be needed for a search and rescue mission, since the torpedo bombers were due to return. The tower operators at Fort Lauderdale Naval Air Station were waiting to be relieved at 4 p.m. As the tower's chief radio man checked over his log before turning the watch over to his relief, the tower received a frantic message from Lieutenant Taylor. Quote, Calling tower, this is an emergency. We seem to be off course. We cannot see land. Repeat. We cannot see land. What is your position? The tower radioed back. Now, I think for Dallas, I should bring him up a little bit today. Now, you don't mind. I tell you, I might finish this tonight if you're nice to me. But I want everybody to get a feel for what goes on here in this area. I just love to read about poor mayor. Now, this is Atlantis, the eighth continent, by Charles Berlitz, author of The Bermuda Triangle. You can't buy it. Most of the bookstores are sold out ever since I started on it. They'll send me a commission. Now, we have it in our bookstore for those that can't find it in their own bookstore. Now, I want to read something to you. This is probably the best summary of Atlantis. There are over 5,000 books about Atlantis, but this is probably one of the best summaries in print. This is Charles Berlitz, Jr. He heads the language school. He's written a good book on this. He talks about Dr. Valentine, the paleontologist and geologist and underwater archaeologist of Miami. Dr. Manson Valentine, admirer of Valentine, has been studying the underwater area of the Bahama Banks for 25 years. And in addition to his scientific background, and perhaps equally pertinent to his discoveries, he's been an active spelunker, an aircraft pilot, and a scuba, as well as a hard hat diver. Dr. Valentine became convinced of pre-cataclysmic, and thus pre-flood, to use a biblical term, civilizations from his own investigations of caverns in the Yucatan. These enormous caverns contain giant carved rocks and animal shapes that show signs of long immersion underwater with oceanic fauna still adhering to them. This seemed to indicate conclusively that these caves, now well above sea level, had sunk below it and returned above it in the periodic risings and sinkings of land areas throughout the Atlantic coastal area and the world. Dr. Valentine describes his finds in the Bahama Banks. He says, the entire area of the Bahama Banks was above sea level during the last glaciation and became covered with the subsequent rise in sea level. That, I'll tell you, puts it back about 10 to 13,000 years B.C. I wanted to test the geologic proposition which states, if the great submerged plateaus of the Bahamas were dry land in the relatively recent past, their shallow waters might well yield signs of occupation of a man. He said, I started work in 1958 taking photographs from small plains. Since that time, we've located well over 30 areas where there are probably man-made remains, either on the sea bottom or below it. I can tell you probably the best summary of where various people have located Atlantis is in this book. And they put it everywhere, from the North Pole to Terra in the Mediterranean to Heligoland. My vote still goes to the area of the ocean named after it, the Atlantic Ocean. Anybody ever figured out for you where the Atlantic Ocean got its name? And by the way, probably one of the best discussions on Atlantis is in this book by Berlitz, whose specialty is languages. I started work in 1948 taking photographs from small plains. Since that time, we've located well over 30 areas where there are probably man-made remains either on the sea bottom or below it. For example, between Diamond Point and Tongue of the Ocean, there's a network of modular straight lines intersecting at right, obtuse, and acute angles. It resembles an architect's plan for a complex urban development with still more lines in the distance, which I would call ghost patterns, since they are vague outlines of other structures too deeply buried to be traced in detail. Now, probably more books have been written about fewer words uttered by Plato than any other single few words uttered. from the mouth of Solon, the great lawmaker of Greece, who then sailed away for 10 years because the laws could only be revised if he was there, and thus cast him in bronze. Reports on findings in Egypt and the tales that were told to him in Egypt of a great civilization beyond the pillars of Hercules, that on the other side of which outer islands existed, like stepping stones to which you could reach the other continent, and beyond that, the great ocean. Pillars of Hercules is Straits of Gibraltar. And any cataclysm that would have caused Atlantis to sink beneath the sea would certainly have caused major catastrophe in other areas of the world, which is why there's such a basis for locating other areas and calling Atlantis. There's little doubt that what the poles in this planet have shifted, or God created the earth in such a way to make it look that. Once you accept glaciation and that a glacial age existed, you then conclude, if things have always been as they are, glaciers move from the north and south poles toward the equator. However, in Africa, you find the glacial marks moving from the equator south and from the equator north. Some great cataclysm hit this old earth. That's a fact. And Otto Muck's theory is that plugs in the shifting continental shelves and the shifting continents in the outer shell broke loose, and the fountains of deep blowed out, as well as that canopy breaking and the water coming at the flood, and Atlantis, the Atlantic plateau, sank. And what we have in the Atlantic as the Carolines, and the, or rather the Canaries and the Azores, are nothing other than the mountain peaks of the plateau that was once above the ocean. And in Plato's description from the mouth of Solon, in one terrible day and night, he says, Atlantis sank beneath the sea, and its place became a sea of mud. Now, if that happened, and it was in the Atlantic, is that the cause of some of the strange things in the Bermuda Triangle? And if it is, what specifically is the cause? Where is the abyss from which the demons come in the book of Revelation? All these questions are related. And where was the Garden of Eden? Now, I said going out the gate, something I seldom do. I'm prepared to suggest that the Garden of Eden was on Atlantis, that the reason that a mountain where you find the gods is in all the ancient hieroglyphics is because on Atlantis there was a mountain that somehow gave access beyond the canopy, in Isaac Bale's theory, that covered the earth and made it without rain and a different kind of earth that we now see. And if the Garden of Eden was there, and the original civilization was there, and that's the place where the sons of God came, as Genesis says, and mated with the women of this earth, and sin caused the destruction by flood, where did Enoch go? That's where he was preaching. Scripture says, Enoch walked and talked with God, and was not, for God took him. Where? And that leads us to the question, who built the pyramid? And why are pyramids so important? And is there a connection between pyramids and Atlantis? And all that is background to what we're doing. The questions of Berlitz continue with Valentine, who gives his proofs that these are man-made structures beneath the sea, going back 10 to 13,000 years, because water, after the glacial age, covered them up. There are cornerstones. The indications are it's a causeway like the ancient causeways. That means the buildings were underneath it, if you would dig under what appears to be the pavement. Now, out of Valentine's work came the reactions of these other things that I was reading that give me the background to Flight 19. And the one I love the most is poor old Ed Wilson, mayor's candidate for Orlando, Florida. On June 7, 1948, he was flying about 45 miles northeast of Miami, flying at about 250 feet above sea level, when a hissing, smashing updraft hit me. It bounced the plane about 1,000 feet upwards. Now, I've been in updrafts and downdrafts, but nothing like this. This is his direct quote. After I got back to more or less normal, I noticed that the water had become bright and silvery. I noticed something big under the water. Thought it was a wrecked ship. It was not far from the surface. Something was causing the water to rush past it at a fast rate. It curled around it, made a deep channel. The ocean seemed to be opening up, and I was now flying low in a sort of a trough in the water with both sides of it along the wingtips. I suddenly realized that what I was looking at was not a ship at all, but seemed to be a huge building down in the water. The water seemed to get shallower around it. I could see a slanting side of a building that looked like a mountain. I was down at about 50 feet from the surface and could see it in the water. I circled around it for about a minute and a half. At my point of angle and from my position, I could clearly see it was a monstrous building. To make a long story short, all of the radio equipment blew out. His plane acted crazily, but when he got it back, with himself safe in Miami, he says, after describing his events to others and called crazy, he says, over the past years, I've been back many times looking for this thing, but I could never sight it again. I quote him, a lot of damn Miamians made fun of my story, but I know I'm right. And he's telling Dr. Valentine, you've hit with the sonar instruments the very object I talked about in exactly the same area. Now, that's one experience. Valentine's experience is over 16 years. Harry Marshall, the Greek industrialist, he decides to take cameras down near Kaisal Bank, where they'd located the place of the sightings of this pyramid. And he says, when he gets to the area with his equipment, and they were going to go down, taking closed circuit television footage of a pyramidal mound off the Kaisal Bank at a depth of 750 feet. First thing we noticed when we got near the area was that all the compasses were going berserk. We spent 8 hours making tapes starting at 700 feet to 1,500 feet deep. We'd go about a mile, then make a 90-degree turn, go back again. Finally, I saw it coming up on the sonar screen. I told the captain to stop and then proceed slowly. We're right over the pyramid. The top seemed to be about 150 feet from the surface with a total depth of about 650 feet. About 150 feet higher than the Pyramid of Giza. We lowered the camera and high-intensity lights down the side of the mass and suddenly came to an opening. Light flashes or shining white objects were being swept into the opening with turbulence. They may have been gas or some sort of energy crystals, but further down, the same thing happened in reverse. They were coming out again at a lower level. It was surprising that the water in this deep area was green instead of black near the pyramid, even at night. And then there's Dr. Brown, diving in the area, experienced diver, Dr. Ray Brown, diver and lecturer in Mesa, Arizona. Five divers, we all jumped in, dove down. I was close to the bottom at 135 feet and trying to keep up with the diver ahead of me, he says. I turned to look toward the sun through the murky water and saw a pyramid shape shining like a mirror. About 35 to 40 feet from the top was an opening. I was reluctant to go inside, but I swam in anyway. The opening was like a shaft debouching into an inner room. I saw something shining. It was a crystal held by two metallic hands. I had on my gloves, and I tried to loosen it. It became loose. As soon as I grabbed it, I felt this was the time to get out and not come back. This writer reports he still has the crystal, sometimes shows it to lecture audiences. Inside the round crystal can be seen a series of pyramidal forms, and when one holds the crystal, a throbbing sensation is felt in the hand of the holder, whether by autosuggestion or some quality inherent in the object. Now that's in the area. They didn't know that when they were flying, when all these strange goings-on occur. The frantic message again, back to the devil's triangle. Calling child, this is an emergency. You know what I'm doing? There's strange things going on in this area. Got it? Calling child, this is an emergency. We seem to be off course. Do I not let your anger show when I frustrate you like this? Calling child, this is an emergency. We seem to be off course. We can't see land. Repeat, we can't see land. See, what I do when I jump from story to story is try to create the kind of frustration these people feel flying into that area. What is your position? The tower radioed back. We're not sure of our position, radioed Lieutenant Taylor. We can't be sure just where we are. We seem to be lost. The tower operators were startled. How could five planes with experienced crews be lost with fair to good flight conditions? Assume bearing due west, the tower radioed. Taylor replied, we don't know which way's west. Everything is wrong. Strange. We can't be sure of any direction. Even the ocean doesn't look as it should. Just after 4 p.m., the flight leader suddenly turned the command over to Captain Stivers, with whom Gallivan and Grubel were flying. By this time, word of Flight 19's predicament had spread around the base. Cosner, the one who didn't go, decided not to go, rushed over to the tower, and at 4:25 p.m. heard Captain Stivers' voice. Quote, we're not sure where we are. We think we must be 225 miles northeast of base. After a few seconds of static, the same voice came in again. It looks like we are entering... Now, we've got one more book here. There's that crystal skull, by the way. Not the crystal, the other guy. That's another subject. Crystal skull, but I'm saying that. It looks to me like that those dirty guys that are on my crew, that bring my books in every night, deliberately stole the one that had all those other stories. I'm sure they stole it temporarily. You sure you dug under the seat, Ernie, and got every book out of that car? Well, now, I'm not sure. We can't continue because they didn't bring the book in. Well, I can continue this one. What'd they pay you, Ernie? It looks like we're entering whitewater. A broken voice then came in. We're completely lost. Then silence. By this time, Lieutenant Cone in his Mariner flying boat was already heading out over the Atlantic from Banana River toward the last estimated position of Flight 19. The Mariner, with its 124-foot wingspan, was bigger than a flying fortress. Her crew of 13 was well-oriented in search and rescue operations. The giant plane carried every conceivable type of rescue apparatus, from self-inflating life rafts to waterproofed radio transmitters that upon contact with water would transmit a distress call for hours. I want you to hear that again. The giant plane carried every conceivable type of rescue apparatus, from self-inflating life rafts to waterproofed radio transmitters that upon contact with water would transmit a distress call for hours. The plane carried enough fuel to remain aloft for over 24 hours. Now, this Mariner, 124-foot wingspan, is already on its way to try to locate Flight 19, the group of torpedo bombers, with a crew of 13. Less than a half hour later, the Mariner's radio operator, aviation radio man third class J. Jordan of Oakland, California, sent a message to the base that they were nearing the last assumed position of the five lost Avengers, but Chico, California is a long way from the Devil's Triangle. There, the New Tribes Mission, an interdenominational organization that trained missionaries for out-of-the-way posts. Now, I went to school in Chico, grew up 22 miles away, had its headquarters and training facilities. The mission even owned a DC-3 airliner used to convey the missionaries to their stations. On June 9, 1950, after a 24-hour layover following a flight from Northern California, the mission's plane took off from Miami, Florida. Her destination was Venezuela with a fuel stop at Jamaica. David Kimball of Chicago was the mission's staff co-pilot, and his wife Hazel was the stewardess. Pilot in the DC-3 was Captain Ben Weatherold, who was also a missionary. Mildred Garber, Clyde Snow, and John Griner, members of the mission staff at Chico, were among the passengers. The other passengers were missionaries and their children, including Harold Mills, William Hoffman and his wife Peggy, plus their two children, Laurel and Billy, and Mrs. Betty Helker with her three children, Nelda, Danny, and David. The missionary plane made a fuel stop at Kingston and took off for Maracaibo, a destination it never reached. A week transpired before the plane was reported overdue. By then, the plane had flown into the unknown, taking 15 people to meet the God whose word they planned to spread among the tribesmen in the jungles of South America. But the most famous one. I just throw these in, you know. A lot of strange things have gone on in the Bermuda Triangle. You agree? You heard about the Cyclops? I'll say that. On February 2nd, 1953, an SOS was received from a British York transport plane carrying 33 passengers and a crew of six en route to Jamaica. The troop carrier's signal gave no position or reason for the distress call. 2 weeks of intensive searching revealed no clue as to the fate of the plane or victims. A Royal Air Force Court of Inquiry stated that the cause was unascertainable. A Navy Constellation carrying 42 persons, including wives and children of service personnel, vanished northwest of Bermuda on October 30th, 1954. More than 100 planes and ships searched for days, but no trace, no oil slick, nothing, of the big four-engine Connie or those who had been aboard it was found. The Navy could offer no explanation as to the disappearance. Go check my car, Peter. Look under every seat, every nook and cranny. This reminds me of something. Am I boring you?
No, sir.
Just making you mad?
Yes, sir.
Confession's good for the soul. The Mariner's out to find Flight 19 now, isn't it? The plane carried enough fuel to remain aloft for over 24 hours. I'm reading The Devil's Triangle by Richard Weiner. Now, you understand why I'm doing this. Okay. Less than a half hour later, the Mariner's radio operator sent a message to the base that they were nearing the last assumed position of the five lost Avengers. But them butts will get you. If I ever get lost in the Bermuda Triangle, I hope they don't send you to look for me, Ernie. I simply cannot, I really want to try to get into this tonight so that I can catch everybody up and we can continue. That's the idea. Now, on October 21st, 1962, was the 50th wedding anniversary of Anthony and Emma Hessler of Fort Lauderdale. Everybody's interested in her, them. Now, here's The Devil Triangle 2 by Richard Weiner. To celebrate, they took a three-day cruise to Nassau aboard the SS Florida. The big white cruise ship sailed from Miami at about 5:15 p.m. on Friday, October 19th. Holding hands, the Hesslers stood at the rail on the promenade deck, looking back at the vessel's wake and the Miami skyline silhouetted by the late afternoon sun. The sky was cloudless. The sea was flat, calm. The only wind was that created by the ship's movement. Am I frustrating you?
Yes, sir.
At approximately 7 o'clock, I want you to have a little empathy for the people that had to go through these things. At approximately 7 o'clock, the Hesslers sat down at their table in the dining room for their evening. You see, you got to get a gestalt of all these things happening at once. What are you counting for? Leaving some people now. Well, just think how lucky you people are that stay. Bye to you that go. This Yamacraw is steaming in the Bermuda Triangle area close to the Sargasso Sea. That's seaweed sea. It was 01:30 hours when the radar operator called out, "Large landmass dead ahead, range 28 miles. "Impossible," responded Ensign Francis J. Flynn. "There's only one landmass on our heading, and that's the Dominican Republic over 800 miles away. The radar operator adjusted and readjusted his equipment. Again, he called the officer of the watch. "Ensign Flynn, the radar is showing a landmass directly ahead on our course. Take a look for yourself." Flynn studied the radar screen. "You're right. It's got to be a landmass. Look how straight it is. Almost as if it were drawn with a pencil. Wake up the skipper. I'm going to check the compasses and take another position fix." The sea was flat now. Smooth. The sky was clear. Every star and constellation that should have been visible in that area was in view. The compasses were correct. The ensign sightings tallied with his previous fix. Still, the radar screen showed a huge landmass directly ahead on the Yamacraw's course. Steaming at 12 and a half knots, the ship had reduced the distance to 24 miles. "Maintain 165 degrees, ordered the captain. Less than 2 hours later, those on the bridge were gazing ahead in awe. No more than a mile ahead, looming up out of the sea, was a huge, dark mass that seemed to stretch from horizon to horizon, reach skyward as high as the men could see. The radar, which was capable of penetrating fog, showed this to be a solid mass. Minutes later, the Yamacraw was alongside the huge mass. Captain Strouch ordered his men to rig the 36-inch diameter carbon arc searchlight. As the ship moved along slowly, parallel to the mass, the men noticed that it did not come up out of the water, but rather started about a foot and a half to 2 feet above the sea surface. Now, Flight 19 is flying out here in this general territory where all these strange things are going on. They're lost, and they radioed, and the Mariner 124-foot wingspan bigger than a flying fortress with 13 men on board and every conceivable water rescue thing on board, including transmitters, radio transmitters that beam and beep when they hit water. They're out trying to find Flight 19 that radioed they were lost. Five torpedo bombers with full crew. And now this giant Mariner with 13 flying to where they last located them. Less than half hour later, the Mariner's radio operator sent a message to the base that they were nearing the last assumed position of the five lost Avengers, but that's where we were. Got that? But could see nothing. See, you waited for nothing. But could see nothing. Other than the Mariner's crew included Lieutenant J.G.W.G. Jeffrey of Los Angeles, California. Ensign R.M. Allen of Sumter, South Carolina. Ensign G.D. Arsenault of Lafayette. By the way, somebody called me about Yamacraw tonight. Yeah, Lakewood, Florida. I want to tell Doc something about the Yamacraw. Mass. One end points toward Cuba and one end toward the northeast. Yeah, I know that. Okay. Some people have heard about the Yamacraw. It's there with the black mass now. And that's not an offbeat Catholic function. The rest of the crew is named on the Mariner. I want to hurry along. I hate to be held up just reading names. Well, it's no more enthusiasm than that. Ensign G.D. Arsenault of Lafayette, Indiana. Ensign L.A. You come alive, or I'll just... I know how to prolong things if you force me. The Mariner sent in. Shut up now. I don't want to waste any time. I'm in a hurry. I'm trying to finish this tonight. Shut up. Don't hold. Now, look, you're holding me up. You're holding me up. I'd finish if you wouldn't clap so long. The Mariner sent in one more position report. Then the number 13 proved unlucky for Harry Cohn and his crew of 12 aboard the big PBM, for the giant plane, the Mariner, was never heard from again. At 7.04 p.m., the tower at Opa-locka Naval Air Station in Miami heard a very faint message. These were part of Flight 19's call letters. Could one of the Avengers still have been aloft almost 2 hours after the last plane in the squadron should have run out of fuel? No other plane would have used those letters. Navy and Coast Guard vessels had put to sea immediately after contact with the Mariner was lost. By dawn the next day, 242 aircraft and 18 surface vessels engaged in the search and were joined with the carrier Solomons and her complement of 35 planes. The operation became the most intensive air-sea search ever conducted. As the day progressed, more ships and planes joined the search that covered over 280,000 square miles. Even the Everglades and the Gulf of Mexico were searched. Land parties scoured hundreds of miles of Florida and Bahamian shorelines. On Monday, it was a typical bright sunny morning along South Florida's west coast on Friday, May 25th, 1973. I'm reading The Devil's Triangle by Richard Weiner. Strange. You get why I'm doing this? A lot of strange things happened in the Bermuda Triangle. It was a typical bright sunny morning along South Florida's west coast on Friday, May 25th, 1973. The sky was cloudless. The winds were light and southeasterly. 46-year-old Robert Corner waved goodbye to his wife. Reno Rignan smiled at his waving girlfriend, Jean Gimble. Corner taxied the black and white Navy on 16 away from the hangar area and out to the runway. The Fort Myers tower operator gave the okay to take off. The low-wing single-engine plane roared down the field, climbed skyward, carrying the two men across the state to West Palm Beach. After an uneventful flight, the Navion sat down at West Palm Beach, where Corner topped off the fuel tanks. He gave the plane a final checkover. The next leg of their flight to the Bahama Islands was over open water, more than 50 miles of it. Then they would follow the shoreline of Grand Bahama Island to Freeport, which was their destination. 15 minutes later, they were airborne. They flew over Lake Worth. I played golf there. And the Intercoastal Waterway, I know you're very interested in that. The Intercoastal Waterway, and were still climbing as the plane cleared the Florida coast, leaving the palm trees and Australian pines of Palm Beach behind. Corner radioed back to West Palm Beach Tower that his plane, number N5126K, was off Palm Beach en route to Freeport. It never reached its Bahamian destination. As soon as the FAA notified the Coast Guard of the missing plane, a search and rescue operation was put into motion. Navy, Air Force, Civil Air Patrol, and Coast Guard commenced searching. The cutters Dauntless and Cape Fox worked along the eastern edges of the Gulf Stream. The Point Charles and Point Barnes patrolled the western side of the stream. The search covered an area extending from the Florida Keys to Portsmouth, Virginia, and 150 miles seaward. Winds were 12 knots, with seas less than 3 feet. On May 29th, as dusk swept across the Devil's Triangle, the search was terminated. No trace of the missing black and white airplane, Bob Corner or Reno Rignan, was found. And no one has ever found an explanation. Back to Flight 19. The Navy Department after Monday was in a quandary. How could 6 planes and 27 men disappear in a relatively small area of the Atlantic Ocean? Later, after a Naval Board of Inquiry in which Lieutenant Taylor was posthumously absolved of any blame, one of the board members concluded, "We're not even able to make a good guess as to what happened. They vanished as completely as if they had flown to Mars," said another officer. A Coast Guard spokesman said, "We don't know what the hell is going on out there." In December 1935. That's it. I finished Flight 19. That's it. I like to drop a little surprise now and then. In December 1935, 3 Cubans, Jose Perez, Juan Hernandez, and Jose Delgado, took off from Havana with their newly acquired plane. They were flying to the Isle of Pine, 100 miles to the south, to look at some real estate holdings. The 4-passenger closed Waco biplane was one of the most reliable airplanes of its day. With its big 250-horsepower Wright whirlwind engine, the plane should have taken no more than 1 hour to reach its destination. The first 40 miles would be over land. The rest of the flight would be over crystal clear water, no more than 25 feet deep. Even the poorest of navigators could reach the 35-mile wide island without deviating from the shallow waters that separated it from Cuba. Perez was an experienced aviator, yet they never reached their destination. The next day, a search was commenced that took in all the land south of Havana. Searchers on foot explored every mountainside and peak. Planes and boats scoured the glass-smooth waters that the missing plane would have flown over. No trace of the Waco biplane or the 3 men was ever found. They had flown into El Triangle del Diablo, I guess. That's close. The triangle of the devil. In December 1944, a group of seven United States bombers en route to Italy as replacements for battered groups of the 15th Air Force stopped over in Bermuda. After fueling and a rest for the crews, the planes took off. Within 2 hours, some 300 miles out of Kinley Field, the flight encountered a series of freak weather phenomena. The planes bounced around for less than a minute. Some of them were swept upward and dropped down for hundreds of feet. So bad was the turbulence that two of the planes were forced to return to Bermuda. The other five were never seen again. This was almost 1 year to the day before the five Navy planes flew off into oblivion from Fort Lauderdale Naval Air Station. I mean, whole groups of planes. You know, I'm stopping teasing you now. I'm trying to get down to the point where I can get serious about Atlantis. What's going on in this crazy place? Let's go back down on the old one. Before we go to Cyclops. Well, that's a Yamacraw. We know enough about the Yamacraw and leave it for a minute. And then there's the Connemara 4, but we can skip that. Yeah, this one. We left this one hanging. It was daylight. Sun had not yet lifted above the horizon. The weather was clear and balmy as the motor vessel Atlantic City plied westward, less than a day away from her destination, Newport News, Virginia. A long Atlantic swell running from the east periodically gave the freighter's stern a gentle heave upward. W.J. Morris of Lanstrasen, South Wales, was on lookout duty atop the Atlantic City's bridge. Morris was joined by the officer of the watch. Suddenly, the officer gave out a yell. The ship was running wild, zigzagging, circling erratically. Then the two men saw what Morris later described as a great ball of fire traveling rapidly, heading directly for the ship. It was on a collision course with the Atlantic City. Panicking, Morris began to jump over the wind dodger to the foredeck below. The mate grabbed him, pulled him back to the deck. Two horrified men lay there covering their faces. Hearing no noise whatsoever, they looked up. The fireball was nearly upon them. Its glare made them squint, making no roar or noise whatsoever. It passed directly over the ship, clearing the mastheads for what seemed like only inches. The men leaped to their feet. But, now let's leave that but. Now, I finished Flight 19. Didn't I? Y'all look pretty bored to me. You look pretty bored to me. Just like her namesake, the mythical lumbering one-eyed giant, the USS Cyclops was ruled by one eye and one eye only, Lieutenant Commander George W. Worley. I jumped around a little. I guess I have to tell you, I'm back to The Devil's Triangle by Richard Weiner. This 20th century Captain Bligh characteristically paced back and forth the length of the flying bridge, carrying a cane, wearing a derby hat, dressed in long underwear, and savagely chewing the end of a cigar. Had Jack London ever met him, it would have been George Worley and not Wolf Larsen in command of the schooner Ghost in his literary classic, The Sea Wolf. Silhouetted against the full moon, one could have mistaken Worley for a gorilla pacing the ship's bridge. And here, looks were not deceiving, for he possessed the strength of three men, as his crew had found out on more than one occasion. Each stride was deliberate. With every step, his foot became part of the deck. Every movement of muscle, from the sway of his shoulders to the contorting of his lips purling around a cigar, was in unison with the heave of the Cyclops as she steamed away from Norfolk with a cargo of coal, mail, and supplies destined for a fleet of United States warships stationed off the east coast of South America in January 1918. The huge 19,000-ton coaling ship her hull pressed low in the water, but the bulk of her cargo rolled sluggishly as she departed the frigid waters of the North Atlantic and plied southward through the warm tropical waters of the northward flowing Gulf Stream. Her crew, those not on watch or sacked out in their bunks below, lined the rail of the ship's bow or bow, mystified by the effect of the prow slicing through the phosphorescent glazed sea. At times, one or another of the men would cast an uneasy glance at the shadow pacing the flying bridge. Those who had sailed with Captain Worley before knew that this was a hell ship. However, there was no awareness among them or their master that the Cyclops was entering the most mysterious area of all the seven seas, the Devil's Triangle. The crew, both officers and men, whether right or wrong, dared not stand up to this walking hurricane. But like the barracuda forever ferreting a coral reef for its prey, Worley, too, had to have a victim. This voyage, it was young Ensign Kane, who, as a result of the captain's harassing, was placed in the ship's sick bay by Dr. Bert J. Aspen, the ship's surgeon, to prevent him becoming completely demented. Yet there was one man aboard the ship who would face down the commanding officer. He was Lieutenant Harvey Forbes, the executive officer. But he too was destined to fall before the wrath of the master. Now, one of the bad features of that ship was the gloom in the wardroom. It was such a depressing place due to the strange behavior of the captain. Everybody was unhappy. It was a relief to take my watch, one of the men said, on the bridge with nothing but moonlight and the nice balmy weather. Captain Worley brought the ship through the Devil's Triangle. This night, upon leaving the area of Norfolk, she almost had collided with the USS Survey outward bound for anti-submarine duty in the Mediterranean. Then there was the poor seaman who was drowned after being hit by one of the ship's propellers. Then after coaling the cruiser Raleigh, she scraped the side of that ship, causing some damage, which made the men think it was a hell ship. All of this I attributed to the poor navigation of Worley the captain. These are all pictures got to get through. Barbados is the easternmost island of the West Indies. Beyond her to the east, this is still the Cyclops on this plowing now accident prone through the Bermuda Triangle. Beyond her to the east lies nothing but open sea almost all the way to the Canary Islands, just off the coast of Africa. At the western end of the island, I can't finish this tonight. Sorry I started it. I always finish everything. This is one of the strangest things that ever happened in the Bermuda Triangle. I didn't realize it would be so. You're just going to have to come tomorrow night. I can't finish it. Most people have heard of Flight 19. Have you heard of the Cyclops? One did. Anybody else heard of what happened to two? Three have heard what happened to the Cyclops. I mean, giant ships, fleets of planes, disappear without a trace. You normally find something, don't you? Now, I think I have achieved the point. I'll finish the cyclops thing. I did finish the rotating crypts in that strange, or the rotating caskets in that strange crypt in Bermuda. I'll finish the cyclops. The point I wanted to make and beat to death, now I'm serious, is there just, and you know that I teach with a concept of Gestalt. I could read one or two of these and it would intrigue your interest. What I wanted to do was saturation four. One, two, three, or four selected out might rouse the curiosity. But for now, many days, I have read nonstop, and believe me, I could go for many more days. Event after event after event. Too many to just write off. It hasn't happened anywhere else. Too many have disappeared in this place. Now, what causes this to happen? Is there a connection with Atlantis? And what is that connection? Now, you want me to pursue it? I wonder if they do.